Hello, again. So yesterday we talked a lot about the Passion, the Crucifixion, Good Friday. Every day is a good day. And in passing, I forget even why, but I mentioned Thomas Merton, a Trappist monk, who also was quite linked with Zen long, long time ago. But and so I was thinking about him yesterday and then again today. This quote of his that is really, really beautiful. He has a lot of really beautiful quotes, but he said, I must above all things avoid playing the know myself game. Because if I don't, it will surely mean losing what little I can find of a path to God. Meaning, if I'm so know myself, is a trap, and it's actually the opposite of losing the self, losing the ideas of self, dropping the ideas of self. All this, and I thought of this. I at some point read a book by a psychoanalyst who said when he was a young man and he was very interested in becoming a psychoanalyst, he read all kinds of things, he maybe even studied, I don't know. But of course he had to do an analysis himself, right? So he arranged to work with, you know, eminent, this was in London, with an eminent psychoanalyst, and he writes in his book that basically the first 6 months he came and he just talked about psychoanalysis. Everything he knew about psychoanalysis, the difference between Freud and Jung and Lacan and Winnicott and all of these thinkers, and the analyst would like listen and maybe exchange with him a little bit, But he said for 6 months he came like two or three times a week and that's all he did. And finally the analyst said to him one day, why do you keep bringing Freud with you to your analysis? I would really like to meet you, as if Freud was a person who the guy was bringing with him to his analysis. And he said this just like changed everything, right, about his work then. And I thought of that. There, a Zen story, and this also has to do with Merton, but a Zen story where this teacher says to the student, why do you keep bringing such a crowd with you when he comes, when he comes to meet the teacher, when he comes to practice? Why do you bring a crowd with you? And that crowd is all of these ideas about myself, all of these different versions of myself that I bring with me when I come. And as Merton says, we have to not know all those different aspects about ourselves. That's not the point. The point is to not know anymore, to drop all of that, to drop the ideas about self. Of course, in as the psychoanalyst points out to this guy, if he's bringing his ideas about psychoanalysts and psychoanalysis and theory and concepts and all of that, he's not really meeting himself. Of course, in psychoanalysis, it's a little different, but not really, You will work with these different aspects of yourself, but you will come to know something, some basic truth about you, yourself, a little different than in our practice, in a spiritual practice, but still. Um, And I don't know if it was, well, I remember reading too that Merton, not Thomas Merton, felt that, you know, St. Benedict's rule, which is the rule that, you know, all the rules that regulate a monk's life in a monastery. It's kind of like here we have all our rules that regulate how we live, you know, how we work together, how we eat together, practice together. And Merton said something like, you know, it's the point is to help the monk unload all of the excess baggage that he or she, or monk or a nun, is carrying around. And he said they need to do that so that they can become a pilgrim of the absolute, which is, you know, this sounds like really conceptual, but the idea is that we have to drop all this stuff we're carrying around about who we think we are in order to truly encounter our true nature, the true nature of all things, the essential nature of things, what sometimes he calls the absolute. But in order to go on that pilgrimage and become a true pilgrim, we have to not carry anything with us, which is frightening because we want to carry a lot of things with us when we go on a trip, right? When we travel, we want to bring all kinds of things. I've had to do a lot of work, like to reduce my baggage that I bring when I travel, you know? Buying a smaller suitcase so that I could take it on the plane with me, and then the challenge of loading that suitcase. And then they tell you the suitcase is too heavy because you can only have 12 kilos. And that means your suitcase and your backpack and whatever else you're carrying, you know. So reducing. Of course, the airplane, they're not telling us to reduce to become a pilgrim of the absolute. They're doing it so that they will make more profits, right? So that they can cram more people in there and carry less weight, so it's cheaper for them, and then they can make a lot more money. We're in search of something else, a different richness, right? The true wealth, I would say. So we're reducing the load that we're carrying around so that we can encounter the true wealth, the true richness of life. So in, you know, with Merton's version of, you know, unloading our excess baggage, that's what we do here too. You know, all of the structure and the ritual that we have is so that we don't have to, you know, we don't have to bring a lot of clothing. And if, you know, we were in a more strict setting, everyone would just be wearing the same robe. You wouldn't even have to think about the clothing that you brought. You just wear the robe. And I know the liberation of that because I did it for many years. It was easier to pack because I knew what I was going to be wearing every day. We don't have to think about what we're going to eat. We don't have to think about cleaning the house or organizing anything for the day because it's already set. And this retreat has been, like, you know, phenomenally streamlined because everybody here, except for one person, and she's just entered as well, the stream, has been here before and knows how it works and knows how to make, you know, how to do things. And there's a trap in that. We think we all know what we're doing. Of course, we think we're experts. But also that helps us to support this practice of, you know, less baggage to carry around. So that we can really look into what is this? Who is this? Right now, here, unload the baggage. And someone else, I forget who said this. You know, I read this stuff, and then sometimes I think, well, maybe I just made up the quote, but it's something like, you know, to don't judge the downpour. You know, the rain coming down, by observing someone who comes in holding an umbrella. Go out there stripped, completely naked, into the shower of, like, life, you know. That, so already, don't judge it on someone else, and that someone else had an umbrella to protect them. So they weren't truly going stripped into the heart of their life, into the heart of that rainstorm, which is like we were saying on Wednesday night or something, you know, it's like that rain is a festival. It's like a hymn, you know? It's like, it's speaking, it's singing the truth of being the rainstorm. And we can feel it if we truly go into it. And that's just a metaphor for our life. So we used to do these retreats online before COVID and before Zoom. Unfortunately, we've kind of lost them, which were called Retreat in the Heart of Life, where everybody just lived their life, but they were on a retreat. Everyone who signed up, I made sure that you had to sign up, so there was some kind of, you know, framework. And you were on a retreat like this, but in the heart of your life. So everything you did, you know, if you went to work, that was semo, that was like we do here, the work period. I had a sitting period in the morning and a sitting period in the afternoon and in the evening. If you could do it, you could do it, but we weren't connected on Zoom at that time. But you knew that other people were sitting at that same time. You cooked for yourself, you ate, everything was practice. And everyone else who you were in contact with was also on the retreat. They were also participants, even though they didn't know it. But because they were with you and you were on retreat, they were in the retreat too. And this this is just, you know, kind of an imagined structure that I came up with so that we could appreciate that that's the truth every day of our life. You know, the heart of our life is it. That's the practice. Whatever we do, raining, sun, snow, night, day, whatever it is, that's it. Can we go stripped into it? And this unloading of our baggage is what helps us to do that. So Merton is quite an inspiration. He lived in a Trappist monastery all his life. And yet had great correspondence. You know, I can't remember what it was, but some, you know, unbelievable amount of letters that he wrote. This was, of course, before email. Unfortunately, now email, everything is there today and gone tomorrow, and we don't have it all the same spirit when we're writing an email as we do when we're writing a letter. Some of you are maybe even too young to know what that was like, that world where we had great correspondence. I mean, I have boxes of correspondence that I have with, after I moved to Europe, with people in the U.S. and, you know, friends elsewhere in Europe, and, you know, it's precious, you know. So he was in his isolated monastery, and Trappist monasteries are quite strict, you know. And yet he was kind of in love with the world, and so maintained contact. And he did go out, you know. He did a lot of photography. He did travel for his mission, whatever it was. I don't know exactly. And he, I think it's him who said this too. That so you think of hermits in their hermitages, you know, really isolated places. And he said his practice of unloading all the baggage, living in a monastery, that deep, deep contemplation, prayer, whatever, however they want to, however it was phrased, but it's the same thing as our practice of sitting. He came to a point where he said the true hermitage is your own heart. And this is such an amazing thing to say, because that means you don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to go off into a cave in the mountains. You don't have to go into a monastery. Your hermitage is your own heart. We have this beautiful koan where one of the great teachers, Joshu, goes to a hermit's place, it says, just a hermit's place. And the hermit comes out. Joshu says, "Are you in? Are you in?" You know, he's coming to this hermit's place and says, "Are you in? Anybody there?" You know? And the hermit comes out and holds up his fist. And Joshu says something to him. And then he goes to another hermit's place. Same thing, "Are you in? Are you in?" And the hermit comes out and does the same thing. And Joshu says something else to him. And so when we work on this as a koan, you're asked, well, okay, so wait a minute. What's going on? Why is he going to the hermit's place? Why is he asking, "Are you in?" Why does he say one thing to one of the guys and another thing to the other guy? And it seems like the two things are very different that he's saying to the two hermits, right? But if we keep this in mind, that the true hermitage is your own heart, how could the hermit be anywhere else but in his own heart? You know? And to say, "Are you in? Are you in?" From a very basic level, Joshu goes there and he thinks maybe the hermit is out wandering or out doing something else. We could say, "Oh, he's just wondering if there's anybody in there." But of course, it's a koan, so it wouldn't be lasting all these centuries if it was just about that. But if we can keep in our heart that your hermitage is your own heart, that's the true hermitage, that can change how we can see this koan, that can change how we see our lives, right? And it's just about unloading the baggage. My own path was, as most of you know, was that I was living a normal life, a full-time job, a child, single mother, then met this practice, met my teacher. She wanted to create a place where people could live together, a community, and so I decided to go and help her do that with my partner. And it turned out that when we actually opened the center, that house that she had built and we renovated, I was pregnant with my second child. So it's the equivalent, because all of us who came to live there were not monks. It was a monastic model, but made for lay people. She wanted everyone to have their own, support themselves and have their own work outside of the place. Retreat in the heart of life. So here I am, living this monastic life with two children, a job, other people, nobody else had children, but they had relationships and work and the heart of life. And this was a very daring thing that my teacher did, because no one else did that, Throughout our lineage, throughout the Zen tradition, if you went and lived in a community, you took monastic vows, you left your family, you left your possessions, you left your work. You did that. Monastic comes from mono, one. You devote yourself entirely to, the pilgrimage of the absolute or something like that. You become a pilgrim of the absolute by rejecting everything else, throwing everything else away. Whereas my teacher had this different view, was that you didn't need to. The only thing you had to leave was your attachment to self. The true hermitage, I'm using my words, not hers, but the true hermitage is your heart. So wherever you are, that's it. That's the hermitage. You leave the home of the fixed self, was the idea. And to do that, you have to unload a lot of baggage. So I did unload the baggage of my individual apartment, a lot of my possessions, because there were things I didn't need. Or I donated it to the community. So I donated the washing machine, the stove, the refrigerator, dishes, things, I brought to the community because I was going to live there too, and they needed it. But what I left behind was much greater than any possession, anything I could, or any apartment. Of course, I mourned my beautiful apartment that I left and the neighborhood I lived in and that kind of thing, but that was really not the point. That was not really what it was about. It was about letting go of self, an identity to self, and clinging to the self, to become a true pilgrim of the absolute, as Merton said. Dogen's famous line about what the practice of Zen is about, saying, you know, to study Zen is to study the self. So that's what I'm talking about. So we look into the self. And it's not about knowing yourself, like Merton says. It's about not knowing yourself. So to study the self, first he says to study the path, to study Zen is to study the self. Then to study the self is to forget the self. So he's not saying to study the self is to know the self. He's saying it is to forget it. This is in line with what Merton said, you know, about not knowing the self. And then to forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. You know, the whole panorama opens because we're not looking like this anymore. We're not fixed on just this. It's like this opens. Why? Because we don't have this fixed reference point anymore. And that's the whole path. And then all of the stuff we do here is intended, like I said yesterday, is in the whole point is that. So if the ritual, if we lose sight of that point in the ritual, then I'm going to throw it away. I'm not interested in it if it doesn't lead us there. So there's a lot of things that we don't do here so much that, for that reason. At least for me, in my experience, another teacher might introduce practices that do that for their students, you know. Bernie Glassman, one of his main practices was social action. So, you know, engaged Buddhism, where I understand that, and that is a path, and I learned a lot by doing that with him. But for me, that is not the essence of my way, is not that. There are other skillful means that I feel are more appropriate for us, for the community in which I live and function, right, for us. But in order to know, quote, know what's appropriate, we have to keep practicing what is the point, what is the point, what is the essence, what is it to see the true self, what is it to encounter the true nature of being and things, to see the unity, to see the divine in everything, to use more of a Christian term. Merton probably would have said it more like that, you know, see the divine in everything. But in order to do that, we have to unload all this baggage that we're carrying around of ourself and what we think is, you know, divine and not, and what is sacred, what's not sacred. I just was looking at these notes. Because some of the stuff I was saying about Merton, I had written a previous notebook, and so I'm just looking back at it. This thing about Merton says, if you know yourself, then devoting yourself to knowing yourself, then you'll lose the path. He says, lose the path to God. Whereas I think it's the Lao Tzu, you know, the Taoist, maybe in the Tao Te Ching, I don't know, says, if you can understand it, it's not the eternal Tao. So it's not about understanding.
It's not the eternal
Tao. Tao.
Tao.
Tao.
Yeah. Okay.
Eternal way. the true way. And in English, you know, the word understand comes from, means, you know, these two words put together, to stand under. So you have this concept and you stand under it. So you're really relying, or you're protected by that concept when we understand. And then, in Portuguese, what do you say? Is it like in French, comprendre?
Comprendre.
Yeah, comprendre. So, you know, there's this, in French, prendre is to take or to, you know, hold. And, you know, it's like, so taking with or something, you know. It's not being one with, what?
Can be overstanding.
It can be?
Overstanding.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not about being separate from. All of these versions that we, in our three languages, it's, you know, being separate from whatever it is. It's about being it, not understanding it. In order to be it, we have to get rid of the understanding and throw it all away, and all of the baggage we're carrying about ourself, about the true nature of things, all of this. And St. Augustine, another Christian, you know, said, if you can understand it, it isn't God. So, you know, these Christian mystic thinkers, you know, they use God in the way that we would say it, or the true way, or something like that. I understand that, you know, that's not the truth for all of Christianity, it's not the truth for Judaism, the whole Judeo-Christian world. It's not, although for the mystics it is, for all mystics it's that. You know, mentioned Rumi yesterday, who said something like, listen to the silence, it has so much to say. You know, and that's what I often say, so maintain the silence and listen to it. It has so much to say. But in order to really listen to the silence, we have to let go of all of our chatter and everything we want the silence to say, or we don't want the silence to say, or what we think the silence is saying, all the ideas we have to, that's all that baggage we have to let go of. And all of this ritual and all of the structure that we come here together is to help us do that, to put down the baggage. So I mentioned this morning to someone this practice of looking, of what we do with the eyes when we're sitting, and this has to do also with silence, in the way that we listen to the silence and open to it, you know. We can even listen to the silence in the sounds that we hear when we don't attach labels to it and, you know, opinions and judgment of, I like that sound, I don't. So this practice with the eyes. So the basic instruction in Zen practice is to keep the eyes open, not wide open like this, not looking straight ahead or looking around, but not, you know, closed. So kind of midway in between, and to just let the gaze rest, you know, about a meter in front of you. Just let it rest, not focusing on a point, right? Not focusing on anything in particular, just let it rest there, the gaze. And then, which I, a practice that I've been doing myself, which I heard someone mention somewhere at some point, is to imagine that you can, if you're by yourself somewhere, you can do this, you know, but in the Zendo, it's not really very practical. But so you imagine, so you have your fingers behind your head like this, and then you reach, stretch out your arms, and you bring the fingers to the point where you can see them in your peripheral vision, can see them out of the corner of your eyes, right? Not further ahead, and not too far back so you can't see them, but just when you can first see them, be aware of them, that they're there, okay? So you can do this by yourself or in Zendo, just imagining it. And the thing that happens, which is quite incredible, is that so your gaze is resting on the floor there, but your gaze is also directed towards these two points out here without, you know, turning your head or looking, you know, to the side or something. Your gaze is there, but it's also here. And it just opens like this panorama of the 10,000 things. It's like opening the peripheral vision, because usually when we're sitting here, we're like focused on the ground and we get lost in our thoughts. It's almost the equivalent of having your eyes closed and getting lost in your thoughts. If you keep your eyes closed, well, then you're really just alone with yourself, the inner world. It's shutting out half of the reality, right? So we open the eyes, and if we're just looking here without the peripheral vision, we're also shutting out part of the reality. And it has this quality of like, you can even think of it like looking at distant mountains. You know, if you look, or looking, you go out there and you look at what's way out there, you know, way over to Coimbra and beyond, or that way, because there's not as many buildings, you know, so. Looking, it's the kind of vision that we have when we look beyond, far, okay? But it's actually, we're just, the gaze is there, and it's also here. And the more we do this, the more that is included. Without, if we find ourselves getting lost, well, then we bring yourself back to these three things, you know, so the gaze there, and these two. And it's something that this developing, this listening to the silence and this peripheral vision like this, this panoramic view, is something that is really innate in us, that our distant, distant ancestors who were like hunter-gatherers, they had to have this kind of view and listen. They had to listen and look in that way. And they could, so that they could hear the slightest noise, you know, or they could develop it so much, you know, there's that stereotype of the Native American putting their ear to the ground and they can hear the cavalry coming kilometers away, you know, or, but it's true, you know. We develop to, in order to include the 10,000 things in a really concrete way. I recommend trying it just to see when you're sitting what happens. A different way of, and if you're sleepy, it really helps you to not close the eyes, you know, because that is like, so that can be a struggle sometimes, right? Your eyes just don't want to stay open and you're like, and this can, sometimes we just have to close, like sometimes if I'm really tired, I just close my eyes and I sleep for 3 minutes or something. And then it's fine. After that, I've done my little nap for 3 minutes on my cushion, and then I'm fine. I don't resist it, you know. But this can help to maintain this presence, this vigilant presence. You know, for like some Japanese teachers, this presence, I think it's Yasutani who said it's we should have the kind of vigilance and presence when we're sitting as if we had a spoonful of boiling hot oil and we had to carry it across the room with a line of samurais with swords drawn over our head, and if we dropped a drop of it, the swords would come down. So this is, you know, like samurai zen. It's that kind of vigilance, that kind of, and this helps us to really do that, to really be present. Not that, you know, I'm not imagining that I have this hot oil and swords are going to fall, but maybe this is a more Western approach, let's say, to just sitting, but not just sitting, you know, we're like falling asleep or drifting, you know. And it seems, again, it seems like a paradox that in order to unload baggage, this baggage that we're carrying around, we have to open to the 10,000 things. It's also true that in order to open to the 10,000 things, we have to put down the baggage. So it works together. All of this ritual and all of this structure and everything we do here helps us to put down the baggage, so that we can see the 10,000 things, be enlightened by the 10,000 things, and not be attached to ourselves. And to a certain extent, in order to do it, we have to already put down some of the baggage to come here and do this. Because otherwise you wouldn't do it. You know, why would you do this? You know, if you had all the baggage of wanting to accumulate, gain, become famous, be popular, have a lot of clothing and fancy cars and a beautiful house and all that. It's not that anything, those things are bad, but it takes a lot of time and energy to accumulate all of that. And we eventually find that that is not where our true happiness is. That's not what the true self is. And as my teacher pointed to us, that I didn't have to let go of my job and my children and living in the worldly world. I could leave the worldly world in the middle of the worldly world, in the middle of it. It was an experiment. She didn't know if it would work. And work isn't even the point. The point was that she wanted her students to realize who they truly were in their true way. And she didn't know if that was how it could be done. Although she sensed somewhere that it could. And she trusted the students who were living there, and there are students who still live there, to realize it and to make it possible for others to come and practice and realize it who didn't live there. You don't have to go live with your teacher to realize it. That too is the point. You know? So none of Geno Roshi's successors, and now there are 7 of us, and there will soon be 8, none of us have communities like she did. None of us live with our students, because that's not the reality of our situations and our students and the economy in which we live. You know, none of us could do that. What?
And also different countries.
Different countries, yeah. It's, you know, so she has successors in. I'm the only one who's in France. No, João Rodriguez, but he's not French.
But your sangha, it's not. What I meant was your sangha. It's
exactly in different countries. Exactly, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And did you have a daily practice?
When we lived in the house together? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah. And it still goes on, yeah.
A daily practice.
Yeah.
Everyday practice.
Yeah, yeah.
A daily, see.
Every morning, and then 3 nights a week, and every once a month, a long weekend, like this, once a month. And then twice a year, a week, or more, so several times a year, a week. And then in the summer, and when I was there, we did a month in the summer, not in that house, but elsewhere. They only do 2 weeks. But they still have that same schedule. They still, and people come and sit there from outside. And it's a very strong practice. And of course, then there's the practice of, like here, where we had to take care of the space. So we had a schedule of cleaning. We didn't generally take our meals together because everyone had different schedules with work and children and things like that. But taking care of the house and taking care of the practice, organizing was before email. So There was a lot of telephone and letters. You know, we did mailings. We like mailed out the schedule, and people would call, and everything was written on paper and before email. When I was living there. Can we see that the true hermitage is in our own heart? And that's what we need to find. So that we can be fully engaged with the world. Because that's what it is. You know? As long as we are engaged with all of our baggage, there's some holding back of our engagement with the world. Whatever that looks like. Everyone has a different engagement in the world. But it's like I said here, you know, the first night when there was a reference to a small group, a small retreat, and I said, no, you know, I shouldn't be saying that. Because it's neither big nor small, the group. Because everyone who is here is entirely here. And that's all that matters, is fully here. Even if, you know, we go off and we look at our cell phone, or, you know, we're dreaming about something, or we have sittings on the cushion when we don't even remember what happened because we were, like, off somewhere else, you're fully here. You know? You're here even with that. So that's what you need to include. And the more we include it, the more we can unload the attachments. It sounds like a paradox again. You know, there was a one of my Zuni Roshi's successor, Daido Lori, who has written a lot of books and created this huge Zen center in New York and monastic place. And he had been in the American military, in the Navy. And so he was big on discipline and, you know, rules and attracted a community of people who were into that as well, kind of a community of perfectionists, kind of like that. But he used to say that this practice was about including the whole catastrophe, meaning the whole catastrophe of your life, you know, the whole shit, you know, all of it, just include it all. And that. Or Tibetan teachers, a Tibetan teacher I heard say who, you know, it's about becoming a total flop. Flop meaning, a total flop is an expression in English of just becoming a total, usually we think of it as totally worthless. You know, just nothing. Can be like just thrown on the floor. Or, you know, and someone else said it's like awakening, enlightenment is like a breakdown. A total loss of self, a total loss of idea of self. Because that is what gets in the way, our ideas about it. So some of these things don't sound like you really want to be a total flop, right? You don't want to have a total breakdown.
No.
No. But you might be interested in being enlightened by the 10,000 things. Or becoming who you truly are, or fully engaging with your life as it is, and listening to the festival of rain, you know, not as rain being something horrible that is going to ruin your life and your hair and your clothing and, you know, whatever, but as a festival of being, of things as they are. Or finding that the true hermitage is your own heart, that you know, that's inspiring. And you don't have to withdraw from your own life to experience that. It's, you know, that's the big message that I experienced and that I, you know, hope that others will also discover. However that looks for them, you know, whatever that means. So maybe we can stop saying all these things and hear what, you know, hear what you might have to say. Questions and comments.
So to open up to the 10,000 things, it's just be there and
yeah,
stay with.
Yeah, absolutely. And the
even,
more
even in the office.
Yeah.
For someone who works in the office.
Yeah. I worked in an office. I worked in, like, you know, one of the most chaotic offices you can work in, a newsroom. Right, where there's like deadlines all the time and information coming in. Oh my God, you know, Trump just said this or whatever. It wasn't that. It was more like 9/11 or before that, you know, Beirut, the Cold War. You know, there's all this stuff that was happening all the time, all the time, all the time. And I had two small children. I mean, it was like pretty chaotic, hard of life, you know, in a sense. And yet, no. You can, it's possible, yes, yeah. And in fact, it makes it much easier to function, to engage in all of that, if we're not holding back, resisting, encumbered by our carrying this load around with us. Yeah, that's it. Of course, in order to do that in the chaotic office, I had a very strong, regular meditation practice, you know. And I was that was my ground, was that sitting, that regular practice. You know, for one last, was there a regular practice? Yes, that was my ground. And even when I couldn't, you know, sometimes I had to get up and take my children to school, my daughter to school, and stay with my baby son. And I couldn't sit with everyone else in the Zendo. I was in my room, and everyone else was upstairs sitting. I couldn't do it. Or I was, you know, feeding, giving breakfast to my kid or something. But I knew they were there. And then when I was available to do it, I could sit. I maintained my practice on my own when I couldn't participate with everyone else. That's the key, though. You know, you can't just say, oh, I'm going to go and be open to the 10,000 things in my office without having a regular practice of some kind. That's a challenge. You know?
The formal practice is really a very important base so that then we can apply it in the daily life.
Yeah, and that's why it's called practice. You know, practice means, you know, like football players, they practice and then they go play the real game, you know? Or we practice the piano and then we perform at the concert, you know, or something. Well, that's what this is. We're practicing. So that we can stand up and go out and to do the, you know, the performance of life. The beautiful thing is, though, that whether it's a football player, whether it's a piano player, whether it's a Zen student, that the practice too is it. That you're not just going through some routine so that you can perform elsewhere. This is it. I mean, it's also practice, and life is practice. That's why we say practice is life, and life is practice. It's the same way. Same thing.
This is the performance.
What?
This is the performance.
This too is the performance, yeah. The performance of you, you know. You are it. You are the performance. You are the practice. You are the life. You are all of it, you know. You are the piano. You are the football. You're all of it.
What strikes me, why do we have to learn it again? Because I'm thinking when we are young, most of us, so we love life. We have, you know, it's joyful. and then we lose it, we have to learn it. We really have to learn it.
Well, it's more what we say in Zen is we have to unlearn. We have to unlearn everything that we've learned.
Yeah.
All the way of functioning, the attention we're supposed to be giving to this or that.
The flopping, you were saying, the flopping, it's one of our biggest occidental problems.
Absolutely, yeah.
We are always flopping. There's no way we can have a big house, a lot of vacations, a lot of great romances, a really interesting life, or whatever, being here, there, and that really oppresses us.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a huge obstacle. Yeah.
Yeah.
And causes enormous suffering.
Yeah. Enormous.
Yeah.
But your message is really beautiful, because I think you are saying it's
same.
It's for each one of us is completely reachable where we are.
Absolutely. And I have no doubt about that. No. Absolutely. Faith, yeah.
Now, basically, to say that this, I think there is a Japanese 10 direction eyes. 10 direction eyes, I think. That was what Ugari said. So you have to have this open vision in Zazen. But for me, my experience is that I see I can drop my ego when I am already aware of the people that are next to me. So when I open my eyes, I thought, there are people around me. Because normally when, of course, we sit now, the tendency is to start thinking about our problems and the craziness that is in our mind. And it's so helpful to sit with other people, because this is already opening the eyes. Is that, I have people next to me. So that is already very supportive. And it's the same also with the Zoom. That sometimes, yeah, you have all these squares, and you can also tend to. It's a little bit difficult, because you have to combine both things. So you have your eyes in the traditional way projected in front, but you have the screen. So it's also a way to adapt to practice these 10 direction eyes when you are in Zoom. Which is also funny, because it's also virtual. But anyway, what I wanted to say is that when we are together sitting, so many times where I am completely with my own thoughts, and to wake up for the fact that people are around me, it helps a lot. And then, of course, you start seeing it's not only the two people that are next to you, you start seeing the whole space. The vision of all these spaces enlarging and enlarging.
Yeah.
And only that is already encompassing things. It is a way to, yeah, to unload your own thoughts.
Exactly.
Scientifically, there are studies that show when you look at peripheral view, you are in the parasympathetic mode. You know, the vagus nerve, and you are much susceptible to peace, and when you focus, you are in the autosympathetic mode. You know, you are more focused, but you don't see reality. You just for concentrate. And there are studies, mesmo in terms of hormones.
Hormones. What were the two? The two names of them?
Parasympathetic mode.
Oh, yeah, parasympathetic.
And orthosympathetic.
Oh, yeah. That's beautiful.
Orthosympathetic is when you are stressed, when you precisas de concentrar.
Okay.
Sabes, tu focas e o mundo parece que desaparece perfeitamente, estás muito concentrado. Mas isso tens muito cortisol, muita adrenalina, sabes? É o modo de.
Yeah.
E tens, quando tu abres a visão, os estudos mostram que começas a libertar serotonina, dopamina, sabes?
Beautiful. Yeah, beautiful.
Mm. That I remember when I was, I'm still a mother of the young, the babies. It looked like co-sleeping. It was it was really strange that you are so attentive to the breathing, mm-hmm. the everything, You're not sleeping, you are sleeping with another human being. And I think, okay, this, she's 6 months, she has to go to her room because I need to sleep. At old days when I just went to sleep. It's you're really, really hypervisual.
Extremely.
But you are sleeping, but it's closely, it's really hormonal, it's biological, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mothers.
Mothers.
More so than fathers. I know the fathers I knew, they didn't seem to hear any of this stuff.
Yeah.
There is the chamber, I don't remember where or how, that it's so quiet that you hear what's happening in your body. And if you stay there for long enough, you get crazy because you feel like I listen everything that's happening, so you cannot stay there for a long time. So I'm imagining if we're listening, if we hear too much, maybe it's too much. If we would hear like our body working. That's what happens in this chamber, it's for scientific purposes. So I was just wanted to tell you that there's a place where you can hear your body working. It's incredible.
Well, and maybe in that, I don't know what that is, but part of the problem, if there is one of that, that you can't stay there is because you're identifying those sounds and you're saying, oh, that's this or that's that. Or, you know, like sometimes my head is a certain way on the pillow, I can hear my heart beating.
We have we have proprioception and interoception. Proprioception is to know the articular position that you have.
That I know from a particular physiotherapy.
And interoception is to feel body sensation.
Which is funny because this is already the first famous sutra of the Buddha that it teaches how to meditate. There is a moment in you say something, you have to be aware of your own body.
Mm-hmm.
So all this is so. The Vipassana thing is absolutely brilliant. That 6th century before Christ, it was really analyzing the body and the mind in such a way that then it could teach how to practice this meditation, because this meditation doesn't come from yoga.
It comes from, and even predates Shakyamuni Buddha, certainly.
Yeah,
but he was a great pedagogue, so he could,
was. Great.
You know.
Satapada Sutra. I'm not so much into this kind of scholarly kind of thing, but when I read it for the first time, I was just, this is absolutely incredible. That it really was analyzing in detail and then teaching how people should really meditate, aware of the body, aware of the mind, aware of everything.
Well, and so then so this mindfulness, or vipassana that we call it, whatever. What has been, unfortunately, because the point of that was to, so we could unload it.
Yeah,
I'm using our language now, but so that we could encounter our attachment to self and all of that. That was what his point was. It was a technique that, like, he was a great pedagogue, you know. But so today, what, you know, has happened with that practice of mindfulness has become like a method. A disciplinary tool, not to liberate us, but to, you know, be better adapted to the conditions around us that are what are oppressing us, you know, stress, whatever that is, and, you know, like businesses become in businesses, they teach their employees mindfulness, so they'll be more productive.
Yeah.
Not so they'll be free, but so they'll be more productive, you know? And so it's like to the extent of Amazon, which apparently has these cubicles in the warehouses where you can go, the employee can go, watch a 3-minute video about mindfulness meditation, practice for 3 or 5 minutes or something, and then go back out on the floor. And the idea is that they will be a better worker if they do that, you know? It's not about realizing their true nature.
The problem is the worker cannot realize their own true nature. The problem is the worker is in danger of realizing its own true nature.
Wait, what? So the worker is what?
So it's like if you awaken, they will be more productive.
Well, they would be less
productive. Danger,
yeah.
It's for them too.
Yeah.
Oh, it's the opposite.
Yeah. Many years ago, someone tried to convince me to go into businesses, you know, and teach meditation. And I said, you know, I couldn't do that because if I did, they would all become really bad businessmen, you know. They wouldn't want to do what they were doing. And I wasn't interested in teaching mindfulness as a technique to, of course, to ease suffering, but it's missing the point when it's to, like, reduce stress. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. When it was introduced, Jon Kabat-Zinn, he introduced it in hospital settings.
Yeah, mental stress.
Exactly. It was like to help people heal. It wasn't supposed to be, you know, what it's become. So I don't want to criticize the mindfulness practice, but because you brought it up. Buddha's intention initially was as a tool to awaken, you know, to true self. And if we can do that through all that stuff, yes. Yeah.
Neti-neti, I don't know if it's in Buddhism, it's the same.
What?
Neti-neti, it's in Sanskrit. It means not this, not this.
Exactly, yeah.
So bring it, but then negate it, you know.
Exactly. And Zen is, Buddhism in general is about all this not, no. It's not this, it's not that. Or the opposite. It's this. You are this.
I read, I don't know where, I think it's in a book that Anna gave me, that Levi Strauss, when he first went to the Native Americans, Amazon, I think, he was in Amazon and stayed for a while with different tribes. There is a point he starts to ask what constellations in the sky they see, each tribe. And he noticed that all of the tribes, there was a point, there is this constellation, they name it, but he never saw it. But all of them, so the perception, the training, the practice of seeing outside the sky, was still there with those guys, and not anymore with Levi Strauss. So there are constellations that are there and we don't see.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay.
Certainly, yeah.
What was at the beginning of my practice, years and years ago, if I stayed a lot of time, I started to, it was really strange, to see the people's, in television, in the real world, every movement. So I was watching people, and they don't look normal. It was like they were, you know, I saw every muscle, everything. Like I was really attuned, and it was really strange because it was not normal, and I knew it stopped after a while. I don't know if any one of you had this kind of experience, or when you feel really attuned, you know, someone throw you something and you can catch it and you're not looking because you are really attuned to stuff.
Yeah.
I was remembering, because the thing is not really look at stuff. When the Buddha gave a simile, just similar to what you were mentioning before, the person, in this case, it's a man, a monk, because it's traveled across the marketplace in a fair day, and with a thing of the water on top of the head, and at the same time there's a lady dancing with sensual, and it just had to cross without dropping the thing. So at the same time, it's aware of everything, but continuing.
Right, it's not that he didn't see her dancing.
Yeah, it was really attuned. But I think other stuff, I'm not sure when, usually I'm with my eyes open. And I have, when I go, when I close my eyes, it gets too close, I think. But when I'm with my eyes open, what brings me, special since 2015, since I met you, I think it's baggage, but you know, it's things pop up from your subconscious, the stuff that you are avoiding or that are there as a big attachment or whatever, they started to appear, to pop up.
Things that you didn't notice before.
I didn't.
Yeah, of course.
I didn't know they even existed.
Right, of course.
I knew, but I did. I didn't knew. Mm-hmm. It's a whole life. It came a whole life since my 40s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's true. We see more. We hear more. We feel more. It's the exact opposite of what people think about. You know, the stereotype of Zen is just these passive, dead people who just sit there. No, it's not. No, it's like, the opposite. It's the opposite.
Just, I remember I saw this a couple of years ago, someone made some glasses, eyeglasses, in which, by some mirroring system, whatever, you see 360. And I forgot about that. And now, I want to try those glasses. probably this.
But it's not like virtual reality.
It's not virtual reality. It's just with mirrors or lenses, it collapses the background, so you can still see it here. And now I want to see how it looks like, and meditate with it once to see real 360. Although sometimes it really feels that the world that it can see is empty.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it feels that there is no back. During meditation, once in a while it feels there is no back. I mean, the back is also this, like, it stops here because it's stopping there.
Mm-hmm.
But with the glass, I
never thought you were doing a session about having back.
Yeah. So you see the back of your head, and now I need to know.
Yeah, you stop. Are you remembering some sessions who I sit with the people? When I sit today alone by myself, I have remembrance from all sessions where I sit. There was Adriano, there I was Pauline. They come again.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Everyone is always here. Yeah.
Because there's no other place.
Exactly. There isn't, in fact, yeah. Yeah. I don't know what our time is here, but it's time? Okay, well, perfect. The right amount. Thank you.
Sentient beings.